pack your bags, start the car, and get on the road. It's time to go across the country, 2 minutes at a time, for the biggest stories of the day, where they're happening.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Boston, Mass.
Miami, Florida.
It's the 2 minute drill on the program.
Let's kick the drill off in Milwaukee with Brian D. from WTMJ. Brian, we're checking the standings, and I don't think I really realize the Brewers in first place. What's going so right for the Brewers this year?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I think the thing that's going right for the Brewers is the thing that's gone right for the Brewers for the better part of the last four seasons, since they've been a playoff team each and every year, whether it's winning the Central Division or clinching that National League wild card spot. It's they have great starting pitching. Corbin Burns is your reigning Cy Young winner out of the National League. He's been every bit as good as he was during his Cy Young season. And then they've had a lot of guys bridge the gap for some major injuries. They're kind of 1A starter. Brandon Woodruff spent some time injured. He's now come back and looks terrific, but they bridged the gap with that injury. Their third starter, Freddie Peralta, is going to be out probably until August or maybe September. But their starting pitching has so much depth. They've been able to give up just a couple of runs a game and squeak it across with some offense. Even with Christian Yelich not being his NL MVP self of 2018, guys like Rowdy Tellez have stepped up. Andrew McCutchen's been a great addition. So it all starts with a starting pitch and a dominant bullpen led by Josh Hader, and then just enough offense gets them to almost 50 wins as we approach the halfway point here.
So are they going to be really active when we get down here to the trade deadline? Do they feel like there's a real chance to do something and maybe add some offense?
That's the one area where I feel like they would want to add is another bat, right? Because that's going to try to put you above and beyond come playoff time. But they would have to sacrifice some of that bullpen pitching that I just talked about. So they have three really elite guys in Brad Boxberger, who probably doesn't get talked about enough as kind of a setup guy, a sixth, seventh, and eighth inning guy. Devin Williams is one of the best young closers in baseball, and the Josh Hader, arguably the dominant closer in Major League Baseball. They'd probably have to part with one of those three guys plus a couple of prospects to bring in a bat. I don't know if David Stearns, their president of baseball operations, is going to be willing to part with that luxury that's so valuable come playoff time, right? That dominant bullpen. I don't know if he's going to be willing to do that. I think they're going to try and continue to piece it together like they have so far this season with relative levels of success and hope against hope that Christian Yelich returns to MVP form come playoff time.
All right, let's talk a little NBA here. Didn't end as well as last year. Can't win a title every year for the Bucks. What have you thought so far of what they've gotten accomplished here in the offseason and through the draft?
Yeah, I think it's been really solid. And, you know, the general perception around Milwaukee, like you just said, is you can't win the title every year. But Chris Middleton went down at the end of that Eastern Conference quarterfinal series and did not return. And the general consensus is, look, if Chris Middleton's healthy, this team goes to the finals again. I mean, without their second-best player, without a player that scored 40 points in a NBA Finals game and 38 and 52 minutes in a closeout game against the Nets. I mean, still Chris Middleton doesn't get the respect he deserves nationwide. If he's healthy, they go to the finals because they took that Celtics team to seven games without him. So I think it really is as simple for the Bucks as running it back with the pieces they have, adding some ancillary pieces. I'm really curious to see how things go with Joe Ingles, the shooter they brought in, obviously a really good specialist type of player, but he's coming off an ACL injury, probably won't play until after the turn of the year this year. But I really do think the Bucks are content saying, let's look around the Eastern Conference. Everybody else is trying to rework and re-piece it together, especially if Kevin Durant leaves the conference. They're very comfortable with their top three all-star caliber players and running it back and seeing what happens coming up this season.
All right, it's always football season around the Packers. I mean, they're not in camp yet. Everyone's kind of this is the downtime, right? But a lot of changes. A lot of wide receiver movement out. Davante Adams gone. Marquez Valdez-Scantling here in Kansas City now. There are enough other guys to step up to Aaron Rodgers to get the ball to?
That is easily the biggest question going into this season. It's a lot of bodies, but not a lot of proven bodies coming into Green Bay at the receiving position this year. A ton of pressure is going to fall on two guys, in my opinion. It'll be Alan Lazard, who's kind of been their like B/C guy the last couple of years. I think it's going to be really hard for him to elevate to year one because he's not going to have Davante Adams there commanding all the attention, right? So that's a huge hurdle he's never faced in his career before. The other guy that's going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure is their second-round pick, Christian Watson, who's coming out of North Dakota State. He's kind of an athletic freak and has huge upside potential. But to make the jump from North Dakota State to number one receiver in the National Football League in, you know, half an offseason is a pretty steep climb. So maybe Sammy Watkins has a career renaissance after a couple of failed stops, after being a top five pick in the NFL draft early in his career. There's a lot of unproven. And underscoring all of this is the fact that Aaron Rodgers isn't the most patient dude in the world when it comes to earning trust with his wide receivers. So if things don't get off to a smooth start, things could get rocky in Green Bay early, and they might have to be scrambling for wins to obviously get rolling into the playoffs late.
Well, it's always drama, that's for sure, around Aaron Rodgers. Brian D., thanks so much for your time.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota.
Let's go to Minnesota now. Matt Collar from 1510, ESPN 1510 up in the Twin Cities, from first place team in Milwaukee to a first place team here in Minnesota. The Twins were like an 81 team, kind of over under total, and they're playing really well. What is going right for the Twins?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, Carlos Correa, even though he's got off to a little slow start in the last couple of games, but his June was incredible. Hit 342 over 21 games in June. That was something that they were looking for right off the bat, but he got off to a bit of a slow start, so their offense has kind of come around. Luis Arraez is a revelation. He is the new Tony Gwynn in Major League Baseball with a 348 batting average. So things are sort of getting hot into the summer with their hitting. Their pitching has kind of come into its own, and there are a couple of blown saves over the last few weeks away from really running away with this division. I mean, they're top 10 in batting average. They're top 10 in ERA. I mean, it seems like it's just a strong top-to-bottom team that has even more potentially there if some of the players that they're relying on, guys that they've developed, whether it's in the bullpen or in the lineup, can start to come around too, and this team could be a legitimate contender.
In a triple play yesterday, right? One of the most unusual triple plays we've ever seen. I've never in my life seen a triple play in person. I don't know if you were at the ballpark or no, it was on the road, right? You weren't down there in Chicago. What'd you think of seeing that one and the way it went down?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was scored 8-5, right? Like, if you tried to tell me that there was an 8-5 triple play, it'd be like, I would be like that meme with the math equations going in front of my face. Like, how in the world did this happen? What was amazing about that is for some reason, the Chicago runners did not think Byron Buxton was tracking that ball down. Like, do you guys know who's playing center field? Which, you know, you ask about, you know, why they're playing well. Byron Buxton is another reason that he has stayed largely healthy for this season, but Byron Buxton is running down everything in center field. They just took off anyway, and yeah, one of the most hilarious. I follow a Twitter account that's called like Base Running Mistakes. It was their day yesterday.
Oh yeah, definitely their day. That was a crazy one. All right, so the T-Wolves made the playoffs last year for the first time in like, well, second time in forever, but first time in like 4 or 5 years. And does this look like the beginning of something special for them? Or do you feel like it was just like a one-year kind of get up and get it done? Because you look through who they drafted. Listen, you don't have to know everyone's name. They don't have people you have to be people you watch play all the time in college or something. Didn't look exactly like a star-studded cast when you get picked, when you're picking guys there. But what's it look like for the T-Wolves in the immediate future?
Yeah, I think that the move that they just made to trade for Rudy Gobert is really like an all-in type of move. They traded, what was it, 5 draft picks in the future to get Gobert, to pair him with Karl-Anthony Towns. And I think that this organization, after they just hired a new president of basketball operations, I think they feel like this is Karl-Anthony Towns' prime. Let's just go for it. And also, I mean, Anthony Edwards, the crazy thing is that I think he may have turned 21 or may still be 20 years old and already is getting in, you know, the conversation for one of the league's best scorers and best young players. So I think they looked at it and said, we could slowly develop this thing and try to keep building it, or we could just go super team and bring in Rudy Gobert and try to have somebody who could protect the rim, and that's exactly what they're going for. The thing is that Rudy Gobert is 30 years old, and if this fails, they'll have given up all of their draft picks for the future and completely tanked this entire thing. So, for storylines for the Wolves, for many years, there was none post-Garnett. And now, over the last couple of years, from drafting Anthony Edwards to now this huge Gobert trade, they are maybe the most interesting team in town, honestly.
All right, now, the Minnesota Vikings hired a guy named Kevin O'Connell. Can he still walk down the streets? Can you pick him out of a lineup? Does he get stopped? Because this is just kind of a nameless, faceless dude who's got a nice resume who's coming in here. I couldn't pick him out of a lineup.
Well, you could because he's 6'5".
There you
go. He played in the NFL. His face kind of looks like my face, and people have said, hey, you kind of look like the coach. It's like you haven't seen us stand next to each other. He's towering over me. But, that's an interesting point, though, that, you know, they brought in Jim Harbaugh and Kevin O'Connell for interviews, and it couldn't have been more the opposite, right? It's like somebody who was not the highly touted coach in Kevin O'Connell and Jim Harbaugh, who's just this larger-than-life figure, and they decide to go with the guy who's more understated and then stay with a lot of the same things that they're doing and hope that the offensive system is better, hope that the culture is better, and that's what ultimately ends up turning him in the right direction. I think Kevin O'Connell is a very smart offensive mind. I don't think Sean McVay hires dummies to be his right-hand man, which, you know, Kevin O'Connell was, and I think that he'll work with Kirk Cousins a lot better. But the problem is that you guys dealt with this there in Kansas City. Kirk Cousins is essentially Alex Smith, only I don't think he's even as good as Alex Smith when you look at how much Alex Smith won over his career and the physical talent that Smith had. I think he's even better. So it's sort of a poor man's version of Alex Smith. Like, there's only so far you can really go with your middling, expensive quarterback. And even if you draw up, you know, the greatest plays in the world, there's only so much he can execute. Kirk Cousins cannot execute the same things as Matthew Stafford did in Los Angeles. So I think there's a lot of skepticism of how much it can really change. And it kind of looks like a nameless, faceless, sort of same old Vikings team because they decided not to go in a different direction this offseason and just change the coach and hope that Mike Zimmer was the entire problem.
Well, we'll see how it goes. A lot of eyes will be grading a lot of these new football coaches in the National Football League this year. Thanks so much for your time, Matt Coller. Enjoy a first-place baseball team. We miss them here in Kansas City, that's for sure.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Moving along to Houston with Ross Villarreal from Sports Talk 790. Ross, I'm looking through. We're going to talk. The Astros are great. Yeah, they beat the Royals. That's fun. So John Wall got paid how much money to not play last year?
I think it was in a neighborhood between $45 and $47 million.
And Deshaun Watson got paid not to play last year?
Yeah, it was about $10 million. It was he hadn't ramped up. The extension was signed, but the big money hadn't ramped up just yet. I think it was about $10 million for him.
What is going on down there where they just let people get paid and they just say it's okay not to play? This is wild, man.
Yeah, you could also factor in there. I mean, it was an injury, so but Justin Verlander, I think, made about $35 million to not play for the Houston Astros as well.
Well, so he's earning it back this year, though, right? So
yeah, he is certainly earning it back, and he's probably going to opt out of his deal. But, yeah, that's how we roll in Houston. It's just so bizarre. You sign this big contract to somebody in John Wall. I mean, the Rockets knew when they took it on it was just a terrible contract, but they were trying to get out of one in Russell Westbrook. But to not pay him for 82 games, to have him get paid what he did, and then pay him, I think it was like $41.5 million or so just to get off of the team. John Wall's doing pretty well for himself. I think he made about $80 million from the Rockets to not play.
Unbelievable. But, I mean, it's when you get one guy you don't want, you got to get rid of him with someone else you don't want. It's what happens, right? You get down this, like, vicious cycle with some of these contracts, and it just ends up that way. All right, let's talk about the Astros. Big walk-off win yesterday against the Royals. Nothing new there. The Astros seem to different faces, different folks there, and they seem to keep winning. What is it about this organization that is able to do that at this point?
Yeah, it's actually incredible that you lose a guy like a George Springer, you lose a guy like a Carlos Correa, Gerrit Cole, we can go on down on the list of guys, and then just other people are stepping up. A lot of it has been Jeff Luhnow, guys, who was previously, of course, the general manager during the whole cheating scandal, and he was the one that was let go. I mean, you look at some of these guys, for example, Luis Garcia, who's pitching tonight for the Houston Astros, Christian Javier, who threw 7 no-hitting innings against the Yankees. A lot of these guys were international free agents for $10,000 to $20,000. Same thing for Framber Valdez. I mean, this has really been, one of the things philosophically as the Astros did under Jeff Luhnow is try to look for inefficiencies in scouting. And one of the things they did is they signed some international free agents. You know, you hear about guys who get signed at 15, 16. What they did is looked at some of the guys who are 19, 20, Framber Valdez getting signed at 21, and find guys who have matured. You can find, it's a little less of a random dart at the board when you find somebody who's older. A lot of guys want to get them, sink their teeth into guys and get them at the age of 16, but sometimes players just aren't ready. And that's what the Astros did, and a lot of those international free agent signings, so they're able to draft well, to get good international signings, and really just keep this thing going, which is what Jeff Luhnow said before he got let go, is that was going to be his biggest challenge, is teams have built up contenders, but to keep that window open is the hard part, and so far the Astros have been able to do that.
Zach Greinke's on the hill tonight for the Royals. Now, he spent some time down in Houston, made a lot of money, you know, pitched well enough, right? Didn't win the ultimate ring down there with them, but is he thought of fondly as a former Houston Astro, or is he just a guy who spent some time there?
I would say fondly, for sure. Just the way that his personality was, especially in the pandemic, like there was just odd games where he would just go sit amongst the cardboard cutouts between innings. There was a time where he was waiting for the mound to be worked on, and he just plopped onto the ground against the game against the A's. And everybody loves that quirkiness about Zach Greinke. And he stepped up in big moments when he had to. It was a little bit up and down, but Game 7 in 2019 in the World Series, that's what you trade for a guy like Zach Greinke for. And he was fantastic in that start. Unfortunately, Will Harris and the Astros bullpen gave it up in that Game 7 against the Nationals, and they weren't able to get it done. But for the most part, Zach Greinke did his part, and he is beloved here in Houston.
All right, let's talk a little National Football League. Lovie Smith got the job down there. You've been through a little bit of an offseason, mini camps and all that stuff with him. What's his stamp on this team going to be?
That's a great question, because at this point in his career, Lovie Smith, I mean, he's had, I think it's 7 straight losing seasons as a head coach when you factor in what he did at Illinois, what he did at the end of at Tampa Bay, and it just not a whole lot expected of him as somebody who's in his 60s. But you listen to the players and a lot of the coaches around the team, he has their respect. He has their ear. These players love Lovie Smith. That's one of the reasons that he was hired. So I expect him to be a really good players coach. Going to come down to a lot of what he's able to do defensively, and then of course what Pep Hamilton is going to do with the offense now as the offensive coordinator, and of course the play of the young quarterback Davis Mills, who showed some flashes of the ability to make some good throws last year. But can he put it all together consistently as the number one guy? I have a lot of questions. There are some people who are big Texans fans who think he is going to make that leap and be one of the better 15 or so quarterbacks in the NFL. I'm a little bit skeptical to that. But I would say so far the players are going to play hard for Lovie Smith, and the talent level, obviously not great as well. So I don't expect a ton of success, but there's going to be no question whether or not the Texans are going to play hard on Sunday.
And it's got to help just to have the whole Deshaun Watson thing out of the locker room. Not there, not around, not part of the thing. That has to be a relief somehow with the organization.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that, and people just looking at, especially as case after case continues to pile up, as, I mean, it's like a no give these back these situation for the Cleveland Browns. Nope, you can't have him. He's not our problem anymore. 3 first-round picks. Some people were criticizing the haul at the time. I said it was great that you could get that, especially considering how long he could be suspended. And now, of course, the NFL has had that hearing. He could possibly be out a year or more is what the NFL is pushing for. So to have that, and start clean with a new slate. It's not the Deshaun Watson era anymore here in Houston. It's the Lovie Smith and the Davis Mills and whoever's going to come along after that era. It hurts to miss out on a franchise quarterback, which is what this city has been craving since probably Warren Moon was the Oilers quarterback. You haven't had a franchise quarterback here, and you finally get one, and all this scandal happens. But now time to move on, and I think most Texans fans have done that.
Well, it'll be a new era for sure with the Houston Texans. Ross Villarreal, thanks so much for your time.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it, and always and have a good one.
Thanks, buddy.
The barbecue burnt end of the hour answer. Who was the first pitcher to have a 25-save season for 3 different teams?
3 teams. Somewhat recently, I'm sure. I mean, within the last 30 years?
No.
Not 30 years.
Not within the last 40 years.
So not since 40 years is 82? And Bruce Sutter pitched for several organizations, but
not him.
He was straddled that 40-year deal, right. Probably.
Raleigh Fingers didn't do it.
Didn't do it. Who were the other relief pitchers? They got saves. 25 saves was a really big deal.
He did it in a 4-year span.
Rich Gossage?
Rich.
There we go.
Gossage. 26 for the White Sox in 75, 26 for the Pirates in 77, 27 for the Yankees in 1978. Gossage, 71 today, the Hall of Famer.
I would imagine most people couldn't tell you that I remembered that he had pitched for the White Sox, but I don't remember him pitching for the Pirates.
Just the 1 year.
Yeah.
Just like Reggie Jackson in
right
Baltimore.
When free agency happened that yep. year, a lot of people just went to a place for a minute, and then they were gone.
Gossage, unfortunately for him, also attained fame as the guy who talked Dick Williams out of the intentional walk to Kurt Gibson in the 84 World Series and said he could strike him out.
He gave up some
Gibson
famous home runs.
His second pitch into the upper deck at Tiger Stadium, prompting the longest layout I've ever heard by an announcer, by Vin Scully. The obviously the first pitch home run that Brett hit in 80.
Pine Tar
home run. Yeah. So he gave up some doozies. But
yeah, and he was asked to get more than three outs often in a save.
Yeah.
Those were different saves back
1976,
then.
1976, he had he started actually the next look at one of the years he led the league in saves. The 3 years he led the league, of those three 25 save seasons, 141, 133, and 134.
In innings?
Innings pitched. And he didn't lead the league.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess he wouldn't have led.
Well, I'm just starting pitcher, or whatever.
Yeah, duh.
Probably
but
close to leading the league for relief pitchers.
141 innings.
Yeah.
In 49, 62 appearances.
That's, you're over two innings per appearance and getting saves. Different saves. Those saves should have counted for more back then.
Yeah.
They're different now. Totally different now. There's some long saves. Before. We had him on at one point. I can't remember what it was about. A very gracious guy. Fun guy. Personality. The whole nine yards. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the evolution isn't just the closer and the starting pitchers going. That middle part. I mean, the idea that pitchers went eight innings and then the closers just pitched the ninth. There wasn't really much in between. There wasn't that much middle relief like there is now. Setup guys. Guys started, and then you brought your closer in a lot of times. And you brought him in the seventh.
Right, this is what it was.
Or the eighth. There weren't as many. HDH wouldn't have existed in 1977.
No, it was pretty rare, for sure.
Royals didn't have an H in 77. That's why they went out and got Al Roboski in 78. Yeah. Because they had Dennis Leonard pitching the ninth inning.
Wasn't the best plan
in 77.
All the time, yeah.
But the changing of a game that is the most rooted in its habits has been
well, the game's turned
few and far between, but it's happened
in a lot of ways. We were talking to Alec Lewis about the different ways they're approaching oddball kind of batting practice things that happen, and we're just talking to Houston about everything that Jeff Luhnow has done down there and the way they scout it. It's not what it used to be, and could be a problem for a lot of people, because the game may not be as fun. That was one of the things we were talking to Tom Glavine about last week. He'll be out at the American Century, which is where Sorin will be. His point was you can't blame the players for anything. They get managed, and the way you manage the game now is a certain way. His point was, he was catching crap from old pitchers when he was there because he only pitched every 5 days. He's like, I could have pitched every 4 days if that's the way you had your training and your body to do all that, and you would have done that. And you know what? He'd be great now because he could have pitched five innings instead of seven or eight. You play what the game is managed to do. That's why now people swing for the fences. They strike out because no one cares, and maybe they'll take some walks.
The idea that the pitchers were more conditioned
in 1940,
even in 1975 than they are now is insane. Every athlete in every sport is more conditioned to have more endurance and have more of a workload now than they were at any point in the history of their sport. It's not necessary for starting pitchers to go 8 1/3 anymore.
Yeah. The expectation
when you
not
can,
there.
It's great to do it, but it isn't. It isn't what it's. It,
they have said that you like 80% of you is not as good as 100% of this guy.
Yeah, they didn't.
So there you go.
Starters didn't start going shorter because they didn't. They weren't good enough.
This falls back to a similar conversation Curtis and Seren had a week or two ago, where it was kind of like how running backs used to be celebrated for basically crashing into three guys just to get an extra 5 inches.
Yeah.
And now it's like, no, save yourself for the next play. Go out of bounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. There's always this, well, we were tougher back in my day, and that's fine, but toughness and I'll say ignorance tend to coincide with each other.
They go hand in hand sometimes. All these games change, but there's no way that the athletes of today aren't as good as the athletes of 1970.
I long say the reason I always on a different, somewhat different rope, but to the same point, the reason I'll always put LeBron ahead of Jordan is because sports and athletes and humans are always evolving.
Here we go.
And so, I use that, but overall, it's just the point to say that in general, the best players in any given moment are probably the best, if not the most conditioned and probably most athletic of any of the players up to that point in the history of their sport.
Yeah, it's equipment changes, conditioning changes, rules change in games. Strategy changes, the use of whatever data they have changes the way games are played.
If we saw a picture of Mahomes in the halftime of a Super Bowl smoking a cigarette, right now that's celebrated as like this amazing lost time in sports, but people would be like, what the hell is he doing if that happened now?
I used to see guys routinely smoking like in the dugout.
There's a famous picture of Dick Allen. It's on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
He's walking and he's got he's juggling three baseballs and he's got a smoke right there.
Yeah.
Dave Parker. There's
yeah.
A great shot of him smoking what looks like it could be a cigarette or could be something else. Just
in the
kicking
dugout.
Back in the Pirates dugout.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, I think the point with baseball is they've just really change the way they manage and operate the game. I mean, you know, you're pitching back in the day, and they weren't shifting the crazy shifts they have today as much as they do them today, because they've figured out a way to do that, and that changes where you pitch it and what you do, and that changes how hitters approach it and what they do, and you get rewarded for hitting home runs. And people, it was embarrassing to strike out back in the day. It's just not that big a deal now. Nobody cares.
The weird thing about today with baseball is as time's gone on, and analytics, and I'm a believer in analytics, but a unique thing about baseball is that more and more the most effective strategy to win is also, unfortunately for baseball, a very boring strategy, and that's the ball never goes in play.
That was Glavin's point, is like the game is not as enjoyable to watch, but the players are just doing what they're told. They're told to hit a home run and you'll get a big contract. Mm-hmm. They're told to, you know, spin rate 2,800 or whatever, and then maybe you can't throw 7 innings when you do that because you lose some of that spin rate, and then all of a sudden the guy who's swinging for the fences hits a home run off you in the sixth, and the third time through the order is an eighth of a tick worse than the second time through the order. So now we're going to put this other guy in to see how he does on his first time through the order. They overthink it sometimes. And that's what it is now. So,
yeah.
And you just kind of get told what you're going to do, and that's the way the game gets played now.
Managers are hired for different reasons. I mean, Brett, the idea of managers being these taskmasters that, you know, have these, it isn't what it was. Aaron Boone would not have been hired as the Yankees manager 20 years ago.
Oh, probably not.
But now he can, because he doesn't have to think about all the stress. There is still, you know, obviously at bat to at bat and pitch to pitch strategy, but it's much more of a managing of a group of players and kind of maintaining a solid direction than it is, should we butt here? Should we hit and run? Should we squeeze? There just isn't as much of that.
Well, it's pretty wild that you're seeing Major League Baseball players look at little cheat cards in their hats see where they get lined up. And that's what they're told to do. People, I mean, I was watching this thing the other day. It was on you know, every like Lynn Dawson called his own plays, right? Mm-hmm. A lot. I mean, not all of them, but they called a lot of their own plays. There aren't quarterbacks today calling every play. Generally, many of them can't even really audible out of plays because coaches want to do whatever. And that was this, it was one of those football life things. It was Roger Staubach. And that was right when those, it was kind of first starting to take it out of the quarterback's hands. And the coaches, I mean, Tom Landry wanted to call the plays. And Roger could barely do a little bit of audibling here and there. And he did some. But it was one of the things that he ended up having a bunch of concussions and had to quit. But there was someone else on the story who said, if Roger didn't have concussions and Tom would let him call plays, even with the concussions, he would have come back and kept playing. Because it was frustrating for him. Because, you know, you got to, always got to do that. It's just different now. You don't think, you know, Patrick Mahomes could call every play? Sure he could. But he's not expected to. Someone else does that. It's their job now. So the responsibilities just change the way the game changes. So that's what it is.
Football is coordinator versus coordinator, much more than it was.
Yeah.
30 and years ago.
At this point, the play isn't even called until the line, at least in college, in high school now, where you got they're holding up signs. And now it's at a point where not only is the quarterback not calling the play isn't even called until the offense is in formation.
Right, waiting to look at what the defense does. Then they hold up a poster, and then the defense does something else because they're trying to discern the poster. It's wild.
By the way, I'm not entirely sure what has come before this, but to the point, there are I guess, some sites out there claiming to be Brett Yormark that aren't, to the point where the Big 12 has had to release this tweet. Please note, Commissioner Brett Yormark's official Twitter account is at Brett Yormark. Any other account using his name is a parody account and does not represent the commissioner or the Big 12 conference. Now, Brett Yormark has not tweeted since 2019. That seems interesting. The official one they link to, 18,800 followers, that's probably going to go up if this is the real one, unless they spelled it wrong. But the last tweet that he posted was on July 12th of 2019.
He hasn't been in the Twitter game.
I'm not entirely certain that they gave us the correct link. It would seem like there would have been more.
Does he have a check mark?
This one does not.
Here's, I think, where it started. So, there was someone named Brett Yormark with the picture, but the at was at Bob Trollsby. That should be
come on, people. Read the names.
And it said, oh, my God, I got quoted in effing Sports Illustrated. So possible new Big 12, and it was this graphic and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, this is what happens. I don't like a lot of things about social media. So you got to watch what's going on out there.
I'm on board already on the record as saying I think the fake stuff and getting people caught. It's just stupid. I mean, hey, you're supposed to, if you get caught, you get caught, and you know, you've no one to blame yourself. But the idea, the desire to see if you can trick someone into saying something that's wrong, this aim a little higher, maybe.
The best parody account was all, and he never tried to be anything but a parody account, was for a while Bo Pelini.
Faux Pelini,
because he basically tried, he never claimed to be Bo Pelini. He basically brought himself on as an exaggerated caricature of Bo Pelini, and it was funny, and it was all meant to be fun. He never tried to brag about, oh, man, so-and-so, you know, I put, you know, Saddam Fefter instead of Adam Schefter, and a bunch of people fell for it because I tweeted Brett Favre to come out of retirement or whatever.
Initially, this Bob Trollsby, you know,
it's a pretty funny name, though. I'll give him that.
Now he switched his picture back, but
yeah. Do you have one? I have someone who tweets as me.
I don't know if I have.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Years and years ago, long before when all I was doing was covering high school football for a local publication down in Gardner, I had a kid get really, really mad at me because I tweeted that I didn't particularly think Matt Castle was a very good quarterback. And he got the account hasn't tweeted in 11 years, but if you look up, there is a fake Adam Dravetta who's
nice.
This kid just got really chapped at me and made that. So anyway, that was a.
You've arrived.
Apparently, I matter enough for somebody to make a fake Twitter account.
You've arrived. You've been parodied.
Yeah, so what happened was this Bob Trowsby put out a statement several hours ago, and it ends up just ending up in all of these, you know, team sites, you know, so.
As much as I dislike the
we've
idea
all been
of it,
got. We've all gotten got at some point by somebody.
I'm still laughing at just the sound of Bob Trowsby.
Well, the Big 12 has cleared that all up.
That was well done.
Oh, God. But the point remains, there are things afoot.
Yes.
In conference realignment talk, and we will see where it all goes this time around. We're less than a week removed from no one thinking that I saw anywhere that USC and UCLA were going to be in the Big Ten within 2024's time. So, that was not Bob Trowsby. Those schools voted. The leagues voted in the Big Ten. They put out official statements. I did always make sure, even last Thursday when I saw these things, I was like, that's really USC. Okay. It's not something. You have to watch it.
You have to, man.
It's a very, very dangerous game. Watch out for Bob Trowsby. Do not trust Bob Trowsby. Trust a guy who hasn't tweeted in 3 years. That's what you're supposed to do in the Big 12. Welcome back into the program. Todd Lebo in for Seren Petro. Apparently there was a Big 12 Brett who was also tweeting. So, man, this is it's pretty funny. Pretty funny stuff. So we will talk, this is going to be a topic for quite a while, what's going on with conference realignment. As we said, USC and Southern Cal are headed to the Big Ten. Dennis Dodd, our good friend from right here in Kansas City who works for CBS, is reporting the Big 12 is
deep discussions
about adding, because they're losing two, already have four added.
Mm-hmm.
That's the BYU, UCF, Houston, and Cincinnati deal. And we were talking earlier, I got an email from a listener about BYU from our good listener, David Stewart. He said his recollection was that BYU was asked to join the Pac-12, but then there was issues with playing on Sunday and stuff like that, and so they declined it, and then Utah snuck in and took it. And they have great rivalry up there. You know, BYU won for the first time in football in a long time this year. It was huge. I remember watching that game. It was just, I mean, the place was electric. If the Pac-12 goes away and Utah enters, I think that gives a connection to BYU in their area, gives them maybe a traveling partner too. Like if you're going to go out there to play basketball, perhaps you would go out there and play, you know, Wednesday, Saturday, and, you know, ease the travel, flying back and forth and things like that. That's the way the Pac-12, when they had 12 teams, I thought it was genius the way they did their travel stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They played Thursday night and Saturday, and you had kind of a travel partner. So, like, Arizona and Arizona State would go to Washington, and then you would play Washington and then Washington State, and they would flip, and they did same thing. Yep. They had these little pairs of
teams. Crazily set up perfect. Two in LA, two in San Francisco, two in Arizona,
two in the Bay.
Bay. I mean, it's essentially two in Oregon, two in Washington. You couldn't have drawn it up any
and
better.
And Colorado and Utah were kind of
they were not odd.
And it's not like Washington and Washington State aren't next door.
No,
Washington's a big state.
Sides of the state.
It's a ways away, but you didn't want to go from LA to Pullman and then
come back to
LA and then go to there, you know, so it made some sense on that. And they, you know, those were things that were money savers too. You know, the Big 12 has tried in the basketball season to help West Virginia in that way as well, where they'll come out and they'll play a couple in Texas, you know, and they won't have a Wednesday and then a home and then a Wednesday in Stillwater. They'll go like Wednesday in Stillwater and then like be in Norman on Saturday. And then maybe like Texas on Monday and try to have like three games to where they're not flying back and forth. Because this is part of it that's 100% getting lost. Kids do have class. They are supposed to go to school. And it makes it hard when you're
Saturday, Monday, back and forth. Saturday, Monday things are going to be, because they didn't. The Big 12 never played on, really played on Thursday. It was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday.
And,
sometimes you get a Sunday game later in the year, a CBS Sunday game.
They'll have one weird like Friday game or something at the end of the year, but it's a Monday night league, and we've had more Tuesdays. Tuesday and Wednesday have turned into more stuff, but it's like Monday and Saturday and not playing on Sundays. You know, the Big Ten plays a lot of Sunday games.
It seemed like K-State played on Wednesday almost every week.
Mm-hmm.
Every other week, somebody they're playing on Wednesday.
Yeah, there's you know, nothing's sacred anymore. You just play when they tell you to play.
Yeah.
And now with the fact that they don't actually have to be on true television, if it's just on ESPN Plus or streaming, you don't have to wait for, you know, some show to end. You just, your game is your game, man, and it's on, which actually helps. You know, if you're not paying the money for the ESPN Plus or whatever. There was nothing quite as frustrating as waiting for Big Monday and there was some foul fest going on in the Big East and you couldn't watch your game. And you're like, there's 12 minutes to go in the first quarter. And they would say, oh, it's over on whatever the channel. And maybe it wasn't there. You couldn't get it. And now if your game starts at 7 o'clock on ESPN Plus, it's going to start at 7 o'clock on ESPN Plus because it's just on the it's not on regular linear television.
No.
And they're not every game that way, but every team has some games in the Big 12 that way. And there'll be more. I believe, is how it's going to be. They'll end up being more of those games as they go because they did their best. I mean, ESPN Plus, I mean, they put the Jayhawks on there in basketball. Like, you want to watch this? You better pay your $6.
Yeah.
You want to watch your team. And, you know, maybe there are more TCU games in basketball on there than others, but everyone was on ESPN Plus at some point in basketball the last
few
years.
It was still annoying, though, to think every Saturday, seemingly, be like, all right, this game isn't on, but
other one's on.
Scribini game is on. Trying to make you something, but
trying to make you watch it, make you pay, man.
Don't sports fans pay enough?
Not according to these places.
It really is. I get it. We're in a free capitalistic society, but there's a portion of that's just way too aggressive.
Oh yeah.
To squeeze every single penny out.
It's this concept that we
does
have
not help
to
help the sport, I don't think, in the long term.
You know, all right, well, we made $1 million last quarter. Now it has to be $1.2 million next quarter, and then it has to be $1.3 million the quarter after that. Like, it's that concept that you can't, like, you know, the Gordon Gekko line from the Wall Street movies, how much is enough? And he just says more.
Well, they continue to pay coaches more. And costs to go travel somewhere cost more. Mm-hmm. Everything just goes up. It has to come from somewhere. And I guess in the end, we shouldn't complain as viewers because forever we wanted to not have the channels we didn't want. So now if you want to watch your sports, you got to pay for them. Now, you're already paying for them. Many times if you're already paying for cable, whether it's like YouTube TV or traditional cable or whatever. So maybe you don't want to pay the ESPN Plus fee to watch the other things, or you don't want to pay the $5 a month to watch the odd Royals game on Paramount Plus with no announcers.
Yeah.
Or you know, you don't want to be, who knows what this MLS deal is going to end up being for them next year on Apple Plus. Is it going to be $4 a month? Is it going to be $19.99 a month like they, you know, wanting for Bally's Plus, where $19.99 a month, while it's not the end of the world when you talk about it could cost you $20 to park at a Royals game, if you could watch 28 Royals games for $19.99, you're like, ah, well, that doesn't sound that bad compared to $20 to park. But when you compare it to it used to cost me like $1.30 as part of my entire cable bill and I could watch all the Royals games, then it seems like a lot.
Yes.
Or you can basically probably watch almost every Chiefs game just with, you know, rabbit ears antenna on your television because they're on network television. So, I mean, there's no real right way on this, and I know they will just charge more until people won't pay it, then they won't. And people have a thirst for sports in this country, which we're all happy for. It's why we have these jobs.
There will always be enough people to pay for it that those prices aren't going to go down.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who just won't be able to, and they'll stop watching the games. They'll still follow them, but
oh, there are plenty. We did the polls last year. You know, like Dish Network hadn't had Fox Sports Kansas City for years, and many people that was you know, they were like, well, I'm not changing my entire thing because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just go with that. And I think there are plenty of people over the past two seasons who had already made a change in their life to go away from whatever traditional cable. And they were like, I'm not going to change and go back to something that I didn't care for just to watch the Royals. And now they've got an option to do it another way. Then they're on pace to win 60 games. So you're like, I'm not paying that money to watch that. So I don't know. It's tough. It's all happening at the same time, and they have to make these decisions that are bigger numbers and more complicated than I deal with. But they've got the reasons. But I felt 1999 seemed high when they initially said it's decently in line with other sports things. It seems high to me, though.
Yes.
Because all it is, it'd be different if you could watch all the games on Bally Sports Plus. All you get is the Royals and the Thunder and the Blues, which that'd be great if they were all here, but only one of those is here.
Yes.
If I lived in Detroit, I'd sign up.
That's not
They're
a
all
deal.
On there.
All right, what pitcher is the Astros' career leader in wins? Brought to you by Good Sense.